Welcome to Best Picture This, where it is always Oscar season. I'm Mike.
And I'm Brian. In this show, we reevaluate every Best Picture nominee from the 21st century and decide whether to keep it or kick it from its Oscar pedestal.
And those that we kick, we erase from our minds forever. Mm-hmm. And I say good riddance. I don't know about you, but I'm happy to see him go.
Some of them, yes.
Today, we're taking a break from the Best Picture nominees 2004, though, which are Ray, Sideways, Finding Neverland, The Aviator, and Million Dollar Baby, to discuss another title from the year that just might give those five a run for their money. Mm-hmm. The movie is Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, written by Charlie Kaufman and directed by Michel Gondry. Here's the trailer.
I'm Clementine, by the way.
I'm Joel.
Hi, Joel. No jokes about my name. You like?
You look like a tangerine.
I want to be a great, big, huge elephant.
You're trying to figure out, did I have sex with someone tonight?
Isn't that how you get people to like you?
Here at Lacuna, we have a safe technique for the focused erasure of troubling memories.
Is there any risk of brain damage?
Technically, the procedure is brain damage.
But it's on a par with a night of heavy drinking. Nothing you'll miss.
Maybe my head already hurt.
That baby's history.
It's all being wiped away.
They're erasing you, Clem. You'll be gone by morning.
Whoa, careful.
What?
Step back.
Broach the guy.
I loved you on this day. Please let me keep this memory.
The eraser guys are coming here.
Wake yourself up.
Why are you working like gangbusters?
I need somewhere deeper.
Can you hear me? I don't want this anymore. I want to call it off.
He's up in that. Seem to have lost him for a moment.
Oh, dear.
Spotless mind.
I want my mommy.
This is sort of warped.
It's just funny. These trailers really are their own piece of work, right?
Definitely.
The tone is so different in that trailer than for the movie itself.
I was thinking, though, that they rearranged some of the scenes, but the movie is all about rearranging the scenes. So
yeah.
It's kind of a meta trailer, meta joke on the Eternal Sunshine.
Yeah.
I'll give it credit for that. The aforementioned Charlie Kaufman won Best Original Screenplay for this movie at the Academy Awards in early 2005. Sharing that award or getting identical trophies were Michel Gondry, the director who helped create the story, and Pierre Bismuth. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. He's a French photographer, friends with Michel Gondry. They had a conversation one day in 1998 and discussed what would happen if you got a card in the mail saying you've been erased from this person's memory. As far as I can tell,
that's it.
That's about all Pierre did. he's actually quite an interesting artist. I looked at some of his work.
Yeah.
He's pretty avant-garde, you know, but I don't think he had anything to do with this movie beyond coming up with the story with Michel Gondry.
The story credit is
he got an Oscar.
Yeah, that's crazy.
That's kind of crazy.
I would think that it would just go for the screenplay writer, not the story by people.
Well, the story has, I don't know, how do you separate? Can you have a great screenplay without a great story? Before Sunrise.
Yeah, I think you can. I think you can.
Before Sunset.
Yeah, if you can have sort of a plain Jane concept, but if the writing is very good and, you know, interesting characters, that can work. But almost does seem in this case that like the concept is separate from
it does.
The dialogue and the conflicts.
And you could easily take that story idea and have a terrible movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this could have gone a different way for sure.
As with every Charlie Kaufman movie. Kate Winslet was also nominated for Best Performance by an actress in a leading role. It was nominated for Best Film at the BAFTAs also, which is the British Oscars, essentially. Jim Carrey and Kate Winslet both were nominated there. This was also the number one movie of the decade by the Austin Film Critics Association.
Nice.
Peter Travers gave it number two movie of the year behind Sideways. Also, just a little bit about Michel Gondry. For the most part, he directed music videos, mm-hmm. and he was like a drummer in a pop band called Oui Oui. French, Oui, that is.
Yeah, his first movie with Charlie Kaufman,
it
believe.
It was 2001, Human Nature. Have you seen it?
Yeah, it's wacky. It's not so good. It's not really something I would recommend. And then The Science of Sleep after mm-hmm. this one is kind of more in line with this, where it's kind of surreal, kind of whimsical, more whimsical than this. It's a little bit cutesy.
Yeah.
But yeah, the rest of his filmography I haven't really loved, which is sort of weird because I was really excited about this guy mm-hmm. back in 2004 and 2005, mm-hmm. and that's kind of waned over the years.
He apparently was pretty much ruthless as a director, like getting, you know, like he told Jim Carrey he met him and thought he might be good for this right after Jim Carrey had a breakup, and he's like, "We're making this movie in a year. So just stay in that mental state.
Don't feel better."
Yeah, and Jim Carrey famously was not too happy about that. The budget was $20 million and the box office $74 million.
Nice.
Coming up in the show, we'll do our Farley Awards for the most awesome moment of the movie, Golden Takes. We'll each ask each other one question designed to trick each other into giving a second Golden Take. And we will imagine what might have been, talk trivia, and the big reveal. Would you kick something else off the Oscar pedestal to make room for this movie?
It's going to be interesting. But first, our Farley Awards for the most awesome moment of the movie. And for me, I think it's got to be that final memory sequence. Carrie and Winslet at the beach where they first met. Mm. Kind of the whole thing.
You mean at the house? When they're in the house too?
They're sitting down looking at the beach. Mm-hmm. They realize this is the last memory that is mm-hmm. about to be erased. What do we do? And Kate Winslet says, "So what do we do now?" And Jim Carrey says, "Enjoy it." And Brian, it brought a tear to my eye.
That's good. Wait, a literal tear?
It brought a literal tear to my eye.
Wow, and it wasn't soft.
It wasn't a big enough tear to fall.
It must,
but it was in there. I was aware of it.
It must be all the horror movies you're watching for October.
I think so.
That's causing this weepiness.
I think so. So at that point, he says, "Enjoy it." And the scene sort of turns into a montage. There's kind of uplifting music showing them walking on the beach. They're getting to know each other. And it's almost like they're celebrating the relationship while it's ending.
Yeah.
And that's really personified when they get to that beach house, because mm-hmm. the thing is crumbling all around them, physically crumbling and metaphorically crumbling. So Kate Winslet, she goes upstairs and Jim Carrey is talking to her from downstairs. But at this point, she's like not even a person anymore. She's just a presence. The way that they make her voice.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of just, it's great. It's just a presence. And he's sort of lamenting the fact that he left that house that night, the first night, because he was scared. And the house is coming apart around them. It's kind of merging with the beach. We see his feet, waves crashing on his feet inside mm-hmm. of the house. And this time, instead of running away, he decides to alter the memory. And why don't they stay and pretend like they had a goodbye and make one up? Chills from start to finish mm-hmm. throughout this entire sequence. It's got to be the best of the movie.
It's tremendous. There's so many to choose from.
I know. I wrote down a bunch.
Yeah. I mean, this movie blows me away. The time when I felt a tear come to the corner of my eye was actually at the end when they decide that it's okay that they're both flawed. You know, they're in the hallway
mm-hmm.
and I forget the line exactly, but it's
basically
like,
I'm going to get bored of you. You're going to resent me.
That's okay. Let's do this anyway.
Just okay.
And the reaction that Kate Winslet gives there of like a laugh of relief mm-hmm. and joy and feeling like, I can't believe how loved I am in this moment. That's like the emotional, payoffs work. And yeah. I think that maybe that's another way to say like, okay, does this movie work or does it not? Well, do the payoffs actually, when they're laughing, are we laughing? When they're crying, are we crying? When they're scared, are we scared? If you can't say yes, then I feel like the movie kind of has some problems with it. And you could trace it back and say, where did they start? But this one, because they work, it makes you like think, how does a movie that is so weird, mm-hmm. so nonlinear, so many strange tricks. How does that lead you to the emotional payoffs that it does? It's quite incredible that it happens.
It's like the biggest trick of the movie, I think, that it mm-hmm. feels so surreal throughout. But at the same time, you're never focused on the fact that it's sci-fi. Afterward, if you tell somebody this is a sci-fi movie, you would think, well, no, it's like a romance, but it is. I mean, it's about erasing memory. It takes place in inside of Jim Carrey's mind where the world is not operating the way that the world operates. And that's, I think that that's just such a credit to the craft there. Mm-hmm. And in that moment that you brought up, a lesser writer would have really stretched that out, you know, said like, this is my moment to be poetic, to win that screenplay Oscar.
Yeah.
And instead she just says, okay. And they laugh. That's so great.
It is. So although there's a lot of other high highs in the movie, I think that one thing that makes it so great is that even the sort of bit parts are delivered so perfectly and the writing is great. And the characters are so like interesting and varied. And so my Farley Award is going to be kind of to a couple of little one-liners that I laughed out loud at. One is when Mark Ruffalo and Elijah Wood's characters are showing up at Jim Carrey's house, and Elijah Wood is like such a weird weasel in this movie.
He's so slimy.
He has like these like long sideburns that make him even look suspicious in a strange way.
Yeah. Anyway. He's got no redeeming qualities no. in this movie whatsoever.
So, so they have this little hilarious interaction where Elijah Wood's character is saying like, my situation is a little weird. My girlfriend's situation. And Mark Ruffalo goes, I'm sure it is. And you kind of realize that he knows how weird Elijah Wood is.
Yeah, too. No one likes this guy.
No, it's just, that made me laugh out loud.
You kind of figure that he's like the nephew of Tom Wilkinson. And like, how else is he? How did he get this job?
The other part that I thought was a weird throwaway, but made me laugh out loud, was when Jim Carrey's characters, Joel Barish's, his two friends, like they seem like a fairly, you know, youngish married couple. And they're kind of like consoling him and talking. They introduced him to Kate Winslet's
character. Yeah, I figured that the woman was his sister. Yeah, I don't know if there's any.
They're feeling sorry for him that they invited him to this thing in the first place.
Yeah.
But it's in like a dream, surreal moment. But the guy, the husband, is
David Cross.
He's like, I'm making a birdhouse. And it's just so weird, but it made me laugh out loud. It's hard to describe these situations because there's so much in the delivery and in the jarring, you know, nature of them. But that's what I'm saying collectively as my
nice. I've got a few here. I won't mention them all. The one I will mention though is a tiny, tiny moment where in the subconscious and we're flipping back and forth to a lot of different memories, sort of at the same time. And it's the one right after Kate Winslet gives the whole speech about feeling like she was ugly when she was a kid.
Great moment.
And please let me keep this memory, just this one, Jim Carrey says, but we don't see his mouth move. It's in narration. And we just see him crawling under blankets, chasing after a spot of light, almost like the Tinkerbell light on stage in Finding Neverland. And it's like that scene was choreographed all for like 2 seconds. And it's such a powerful image. It's one of those that kind of sticks with me, even though it was only on screen for a couple seconds.
Yep. Golden takes. What's your golden take, Mike?
My golden take is that this movie is life-affirming and love-affirming. You know, the idea of erasing your memories is seen as bad. We even get a shot of this woman at the La Cuna, at this doctor's facility where they do the erasing. And she's erasing her pet from her memory. You know, kind of just hammering home this idea that we are completely unwilling to deal with any negative emotions at this point. And that's a bad thing. And plus, they do meet in Montauk at the end, even though that sort of direction from Kate Winslet was only in his memory, in his imagination. So it's kind of like there's a little magical connection thing going on there. Love will transcend or whatever. But I think that the philosophy of the movie rises above that simple life-affirming thing, because really, this movie is pain-affirming, which I really like. I think that complicates that a little bit. It affirms the value of pain, the necessity of feeling it and facing it in order to live an honest and full life. And even the fact that Jim Carrey sort of saves the memory of Kate Winslet in his mind by hiding her in memories of shame and humiliation, these are painful memories. So it's almost like by giving her access to these memories, which these are secrets about himself that she was pushing him to give her, he's sort of learning about intimacy. He saves the relationship all through pain. And I don't think that we see messages like this in movies very often. It's usually like, if the movie is obsessed with pain, it's through the lens of depression, or it's to get to a place where the character feels okay enough to meet somebody else that solves all of his problems and he can, quote, move on. Mm-hmm. It's not like feel the pain, but also know that there's some sort of optimism in that negative experience.
I think that what you're saying kind of illustrates how deep of a thinker Pierre Bismuth actually was.
Yeah, he's good. he was really good.
Hiding in memories of shame because they're beyond the reach.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just so fascinating. Interesting ideas. Yeah,
shame saves him. Pain saves them.
And yet the shame, some of the most shame that he felt was maybe when he was rejecting her. Actually, they probably felt the most shame in the movie when they're listening to each other's insulting tapes of each other.
Yeah.
But, and that's what brought them together.
Yeah. And in the end, they're getting a moment of real honesty there.
Pure vulnerability.
Yes.
Unadulterated.
That scene is so good. They're just talking in the background, those cassette tapes.
Are you screwing with me?
Yeah. Just criticizing the other person and having to just kind of pretend like everything is normal. Hey, do you want a drink? You know, trying to act like everything is fine on top of that soundtrack it's beautiful. Beautiful.
So my golden take is that, like Punch Drunk Love, our kind of similar discussion about that movie was that this movie does things that you could only possibly do in a movie. I don't think you could accomplish what they're doing in a book or anything else. And in this, it's kind of, it feels like it's kind of the bulk of the movie. It's basically the journey of the movie is going through his old memories.
Yeah.
The memory erasure. And one thought that came, one of the scenes that stands out to me is when they're in the Chinese restaurant and he walks out of there and somehow he's in a bookstore. And then he walks back to the Chinese restaurant and it's empty. It's just the one table. And, you know, there's a spotlight that they're running away from the edges of the spotlight. And that kind of represents the limits of the memory. And all these things are visually communicated.
Yeah.
You know what's going on. Mm-hmm. It's the most bizarre, confusing stuff that seems to be going on. It's all fantasy and surrealism, and yet you can comprehend it.
Yeah.
It's communicating with you almost on a subconscious level with just pure random images seemingly that are put together. Even like all of a sudden a car falls from the sky and lands on another one. And you don't think, wait, hold on a second. Where did that car come from? Because
she's missing a leg at one point when he's chasing after her in the street. She just has one leg walking.
Right.
But it's like you completely understand how this world is falling apart. His world is falling apart. And it doesn't follow the rules of, physics anymore.
How do you write that in a screenplay? How do you say in a screenplay, this is how this is going to be? So it's not really just Kaufman. It also has to be the director, Gondry. It has to be the cinematographer who's all doing this all together. The actors and actresses have to be delivering exactly what needs to happen to have the visuals communicate what they're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's just everything is working perfectly together. It's visual storytelling at its finest.
And in addition to that, you have them going in and out of these memories where they're playing the roles of themselves in that memory and then breaking that wall and interacting within it. And we're never confused. Like, so are they talking, like, did this actually happen? Or is this his imagination interacting with Winslet in, quote, present day?
So here's another in that list of people that roles in the movie that have to work perfectly. The editing.
The
editing is like almost just as important as anything else we just mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, this illustrates it that there were times during the shooting that Jim Carrey had to say, now, are we in the lucid part here? Or are we in like, is this really happening?
Mm-hmm.
He didn't even always know because you wouldn't really be able to tell unless it's edited right.
Yeah.
So
you've got to have a lot of trust the people who are just basically telling you, all right, stand in this room and do this, because it's got to be disorienting.
How could you not trust Charlie Kaufman at this point, though? After being John Malkovich.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't see Human Nature.
But, yeah, I don't think you need to see
it. But
by that adaptation, he's established what his thing is.
This as the third in that like trifecta, and I still haven't seen Synecdoche.
That's even crazier.
Which I'm very excited to see. Mm-hmm. But Charlie Kaufman said, I was interested in writing a movie about a relationship, not a romance. I didn't want to contribute to the rom-com genre, as I've had an unfortunate relationship with those types of movies. Growing up, I had expectations about my life that were never met. Then he said, I'm happy to hear people call the film romantic because it means we came to it honestly with no intent to sugarcoat or soften anything, unquote. So that's Charlie Kaufman's idea of the movie.
I love it.
So
questions.
I'll go first. Charlie Kaufman also said, I embrace the notion of failure. The only way to do something interesting is not care if you fail. So my question to you is Charlie Kaufman the most daring movie maker of the 21st century?
That's a big, big statement.
It is.
I will say that he's the most successful, daring filmmaker of the 21st century.
You could dare and not succeed.
Yes. And those are not the guys that we're going to be seeing getting all these headlines, you know. But especially that he was able to make that transition from writer to writer-director.
Yep.
That kind of shows that, you know, people respect his work enough to say, you got more freedom, you know, let's see what you can do. And in Synecdoche, New York, you'll see. He brings it to the next step. And I haven't seen that, I don't think, since it came out about.
Like 07-ish or 09?
That feels right. So I'm looking forward to seeing that again. But yeah, I do love that he's just all about these big swings. You know, he does set out to make a movie, it seems, with the intention of like being okay with it sucking, with it being incomprehensible.
So who else,
laughable.
Who else is in this category? David Lynch.
Yeah.
Quentin Tarantino.
I don't know about Tarantino.
Christopher Nolan.
I don't know about him either. I would say Lynch for sure.
Yeah.
They're both in that sort of zone where if the thing doesn't land right, it's not going to make any sense. And if it doesn't make any sense at all, then you've just, what do you got on your hands? You know, it's like if Tarantino's movie doesn't really exactly land, you can probably just trim off like 45 minutes of people talking and you'll still have a plot.
He should have split up more of his movies like Kill Bill 1 and 2.
Yeah. But with these, if, you know, if Mulholland Drive doesn't land, there's nothing that you can really chop up unless you want to completely rework it into a linear narrative, and that changes the whole goal. So yeah, I think that's fair to say that Kaufman's up there, at least in the top three.
This set of three is it's tough to beat this with one movie maker for me. Being John Malkovich adaptation in this movie.
Yeah, it's a strong trio. All right, my question for you, Andrew Saris, The Observer. He says, it just so happens that I am sick of fragmentation as a narrative device. With the speeded up time machine at their disposal, Mr. Gondry and Mr. Kaufman prevent Joel and Clementine from having the time to establish an emotional rapport that is worth saving or remembering. There is little charm in the coupling and almost no erotic intimacy, just a series of nerve-wracking conversational collisions, unquote. Obviously, by now, it's clear that I disagree. And I think that you do too. But there is a lot of surrealism and fragmentation in this movie. So I think it's fair to explore the chemistry question. Mm-hmm. So did you feel that between Joel and Clementine? Or is it more that you're just so sort of swept away in, you know, in the kind of magical disorientation of it? And that makes you punch drunk.
I felt every bit of the relationship in the movie, I thought that it's also pretty, it's great because when two characters meet for the first time, that's where you sometimes get a lot of the excitement, and, you understand a lot about the dynamics of the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
We get that like a couple times in the movie, couple of meetings. And, the coming in and out, the how much they seem worried that it's not going to last, or he wants to get back together, or I thought the chemistry was absolutely pitch perfect in every scene.
It's funny rewatching this for this time. The very first time that we see them meet, and Joel is very introverted, pretty awkward, and she's obviously the opposite, and she keeps sort of pursuing him. I did think, why would she be interested in him? But then later on in the movie, you remember, like, Oh, yeah.
You realize why.
This is not the first time that they're meeting. The actual first time that they met was way more natural. They were on the beach and they actually had more of a conversation. It wasn't just her basically trying to force this relationship to happen.
Yeah. So let's talk for a second, though, about this, the manic pixie dream girl situation.
Yeah.
So supposedly at the end of the, toward the end of the movie, she's saying, too many guys think I'm a concept or I complete them or mm-hmm. I'm going to make them alive, but I'm just a effed up girl who's looking for my own peace of mind. Don't assign me yours. This is supposedly like the reaction against the manic pixie dream girl stock character. That was kind of coined by, what's the guy's name here? I've got it somewhere. Rabin? I'm not sure I pronounce his last name. Anyway, I don't know. Is this sort of like a stock character that's not, doesn't feel real at any moment to you at all?
I
just said it was pitch perfect in every way, but as you're talking about this and those first interactions, would he go for her? Would she go for him? You know, these kind of things.
Well, I don't think in that first time that they meet, that we see them meeting in the movie, that does really make much sense. But then once we understand that they were meeting there on a subconscious level, and on a subconscious level, they both know who each other are, and that's where the draw comes from.
Yeah.
Then that completely washed away my concern that this doesn't make any sense. But she does ride the line of being a character that a little overly volatile, overly everything, to the point where you kind of...
quirkiness for quirkiness sake.
Yes,
sometimes.
But I think the manic pixie dream girl thing, it sort of implies that the character doesn't have any agency of their own, and they kind of just exist to fix a guy.
Yeah,
you know, like a Garden State. You have the same thing with
that's
Natalie
the criticism
Portman.
Of that stock character that they're not. It's almost
don't
misogynistic.
Assign me yours. Yeah, it's not my job to fix you. You figure it out. A relationship is supposed to be mutual. So I think that she does avoid that. But she comes close. I mean, if people were to say that she should be included in that canon, you know, just to kind of help define the term, I wouldn't really argue it.
Yeah.
But I would say, you know, use her as an example, not the example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that. I think there are times when it kind of toes that line. But overall, I still think it works. And you definitely feel, you know, her loss and her... I mean, it's also helps that it's Jim Carrey.
Mm-hmm.
Right, he's being a kind of a dud, but he also is fun. You can believe it when they're having fun together. And this is the power of movie stars in some ways to solve some of these issues,
mm-hmm.
because Kate Winslet is like totally radiant and, you know, incredible in the movie, and you know you
and it's jarring to see Jim Carrey so tamped down.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, you have his comic persona that's so big, and then here he looks sad and serious for most of the time, and that forces you to pay attention.
It's so different for her too. I mean, she's British accent, very like a, you know,
very noble,
regal.
Playing very noble roles usually,
and it's kind of the opposite for both, which is pretty interesting.
Back to the chemistry question for a second, though. I don't really agree with Sarah's either. And I think I was thinking about why. I was thinking about what is it about their relationship that I believe. And I think that a lot of it has to do with, we see so much negative early on, you know, because this starts at the end of their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So we see all of their petty fights, like in the Chinese place where she's kind of yelling at him for not cleaning off the soap in the shower. And then we see worse fights where they say really horrible things to each other. And that takes up so much of what we see that by the time we start seeing the more positive memories, it kind of like, it has this effect of balancing it out. And it's almost like you're ready to see those at that point. So they mean more. And I feel like because of that, you don't have to have that much of them in order to kind of feel that relief. And they never get sappy.
I also think that maybe the reason that these characters were written the way they were is that, I mean, I get the criticism of the manic pixie dream girl situation, but I also think that when we meet people for the first time, sometimes we do kind of not totally act yourself. You kind of, maybe you are a little bit quirkier than some people are. I mean, I don't have any quirks.
No,
exactly.
No, you're very level.
I'm more like, you know, sort of commanding, you know, leadership sort of.
I can see that. Yeah.
But
leadership,
but you, but you kind of have, so I think it, in some ways it's kind of true to life that that people act a little bit, you know, they are trying to get attention, mm-hmm. because you're meeting somebody and you want them to sort of remember you and you want to impress them. So maybe that is partly just how it's true to life writing.
Yes. The ending, mm-hmm. you know, I bring up the life affirming, love affirming thing, mm-hmm. but did you notice at the very end of the movie when they're sort of running in the snow, then the movie starts fading out to white on the beach covered in snow, and then it repeats.
Yeah. It keeps repeating itself.
And then it repeats again. And that happens like 3 or 4 times. Yep. What do you make of that?
Good question. I think that it would be, I think there's probably not enough made of the closing image. Like, we should probably be talking more about the very last thing you see on a movie more often, because I think that it's very purposeful. The fact that it keeps repeating and he keeps, you know, hitting the snow at her as a playful thing, I guess I feel like it's a positive, I don't know. You're supposed to, it's sort of like a heavenly, this is their great relationship, but it also is like from a distance, you're not, it could be close up, but they chose very far away, to see them running off into the distance.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'd have to think more about that. What did you make of it?
The music playing, Everybody's Gotta Learn Sometime.
Mm-hmm.
To me, this says that we will never learn this mm-hmm. scene, that mm-hmm. we're just going to keep repeating this pattern over and over again of we're overly optimistic at the beginning of a relationship. And then when we're feeling sad, we're overly destructive mm-hmm. about everything that came before it. And I almost kind of feel like we're sort of doomed to not be realists when it comes to love and relationships. And that when we do reach that point again, that we get to the end and we break up, because we haven't even addressed the fact of whether or not these two people should be together in the first place. I don't think that they should, but I think that the movie doesn't care about that.
They shouldn't. Why not?
Because
they're totally in love with each other.
Are they?
Oh yeah.
Maybe they were very in love with each other for a year. They're only together for 2 years. I mean, this was not a long, long, long relationship. To me, it's polar opposite people. Mm-hmm. They met and, you know, she awakens something in him and he's a reflective guy and, you know, that kind of works. You know, she pulls him along. But after a while, if that wears you down and she needs somebody who's a little more high energy and a little more adventurous and she does get bored of him, that's okay that they're not meant to be together. I think what's not okay is then saying, well, let's deny that this relationship ever happened. Let's deny feeling that loss because I feel sad right now. So, like, I don't think that the question of whether or not they belong together is kind of even ever posed here. Mm-hmm. I think it's much more about how we deal with things that make us feel sad.
I think that whether they belong together is answered by their, you know, discussion in the hallway at the end where they agree that, okay, we are going to get tired of each other, but it's okay. It's still worth it. You know, I don't think that it's...
See, I think that's more about life experience. Like, yes, this is going to fail. Yes, I am going to get tired of you. Yes, I am going to resent you.
So,
but this is a part of our life. And if we deny going through the process of falling in love and then being disappointed and falling out of love and being depressed, then what is this life about? What are we doing?
Mm-hmm. In the screenplay, this was not actually made as part of the movie, but there's a scene where they're much older and you see like this evidence that they have, or she has purposely forgotten him like 15 times over her lifetime.
Yeah.
I guess again, showing that, well, maybe the beginning, the excitement of meeting someone for the first time is it all going to work out. Is it saying that that's the best part and it's always going to go downhill after that?
I think it's just saying that we're slaves to our emotions and whatever we feel in the moment, we want to see that through all the way to the end.
I like the idea of thinking that there is a point in a relationship where you do have to be, a relationship can change you. You are going to change. You're not going to be the same exact person every, you know, for your whole life. And the question is, are you willing to allow your changes and her changes
mm-hmm.
go together? Are you going to accept her changes and hope that she accepts your changes, or are you not? And I think that at the end of the movie, where it kind of goes on a little bit of a loop, I think, and they're still happy each time because it's the same loop. Maybe we're expected to think that it's going to work out.
I respectfully disagree. I don't buy it, but I do buy that this movie believes in the power of experience and connection, and that if we decide to erase the pain, then we're also deciding to erase
the good
things and what that brought to our life. Mm-hmm. And without it, you know, without pain, what are we, Brian?
I love pain.
we're shells. I'm gonna say we deny our pain.
There's no game without pain. You can write that down.
That's pretty smart. It's pretty smart. All right. What might have been?
What might have been? Nicolas Cage as Joel.
Nope.
Michelle Gondry's first choice was really? Nicolas Cage. Yeah.
I mean, okay.
Could he have done the little kid scenes under the table in the same way?
Yeah. I mean, I do like Jim Carrey in this. I don't think I'd love him. I love what he brings. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love the contrast with this comic persona, but I could see Cage doing it, I guess.
No way.
You just hate Nicolas Cage.
Seth Rogen auditioned for the role of Elijah Wood.
I could see it.
I could see it too, but it would be, obviously you put somebody else in there, the movie is totally different. I love how Elijah Wood makes it work. Although, can you even for a second buy Kate Winslet being with Elijah Wood?
Honestly, I don't buy, yeah, I thought you were going to say with Seth Rogen, but yeah, I don't buy her being with
either
Elijah
one,
Wood.
Really, yeah.
And I think we're supposed to feel that way because the whole time she knows this is wrong. This does not mm-hmm. feel right. But, you know, she's kind of baited and drawn because he's using all of Joel's memories against her, basically. So it's like in any normal circumstances, she wouldn't be with Elijah Wood.
So is this role that Elijah Wood is playing, is it like a cross between Frodo and Gollum?
I don't know what this role is. I just love that he's in this movie at like the height of Lord of the Rings, and he's so unlikable, not really doing a whole lot. Yeah. He's in this movie just to be hated.
I know. Tracy Morgan had a role and was cut.
I wonder what that was.
I don't know.
That'd be cool.
I'd love to throw Tracy Morgan into the movie.
Yeah.
Ellen Pompeo, who was most famous for playing Grey's Anatomy, was Joel's girlfriend, and she had scenes, and they were cut from the movie as well.
Hmm.
Thought that was kind of interesting. Okay, so this is what might have been on a macro level. Charlie Kaufman said during an interview in 2004 that he was excited about his next project because it was going to be a horror movie directed by Spike Jonze, who had just done John Malkovich with him in adaptation.
But we don't know what that is.
I don't think it ever happened. I mean, you look at his list of movies and he didn't do anything with Spike Jonze anywhere near there.
Yeah.
So I mean, guessing it just didn't happen, but I would love to see Charlie Kaufman write a horror movie directed by Spike Jonze.
Yeah, I could see it. His latest movie is kind of a horror movie.
What is that called?
I think You Should Leave Now.
I looked at his
list. I'm Thinking of Ending Things. That's okay, it. Yeah. On Netflix, I think last year or the year before.
And he directed that.
Right? He directed that, and that's definitely got a lot of horror elements to it. It's another one of those that kind of ride the line between like how do you define a horror movie, but I think that there are enough elements in there that are supposed to be unsettling and creepy.
I'll be
and
the judge of that when I watch it.
Okay.
We seem to have quite different understandings of what makes something a horror
movie. You try
to
put him in a box with all these rules.
You try to give it no rules.
It's all about tone.
Anything's a horror movie.
It's about tone and approach and style and scoring and lighting.
Even The Village doesn't even call itself a horror movie.
The Village has full sections where monsters are going to attack people.
You put it right into our three horror movies in one.
That's because it's a horror movie. The first, half of it, they're in a town that's surrounded by woods, and in those woods, full of monsters. How else do you define a horror movie?
It says it's a suspense thriller. Kate Winslet secured the role of Clementine. But Charlie Kaufman was hoping for someone, and that was good because he wanted someone who just won an actor, won an Oscar. I don't know why that would be, but I guess maybe using the star power. I don't know. But two people that were possibly considered is Nicole Kidman, Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Interesting.
I can't see anyone but Kate Winslet doing it.
Yeah, yeah. It kind of seems like her part, but I don't know. I do like Nicole Kidman and like everything that I've seen her in. So
Denzel Washington as Joel Barish. He apparently turned it down.
It doesn't seem like his energy, but I don't know.
Well, neither is, it's not Jim Carrey's energy either. I don't know. It worked out pretty well though for Jim Carrey.
Okay,
trivia. Michelle Gondry plays drums on Kanye West, well, FKA Kanye West, now known as Ye. He plays drums on his song Diamonds from Sierra Leone.
Really?
He does. He also posted a YouTube video called Michelle Gondry Solves a Rubik's Cube with His Feet.
He has a weird life. I wonder what his life is just most of the time. What is he doing right now?
It's very similar to watching Eternal Sunshine. Yeah. Charlie Kaufman signed on to do the movie, and he almost pulled out of the movie because Memento came out. And he's like, they're playing around with memory here. I don't want to repeat it and make it look like we're doing something similar.
Huh.
Kind of interesting.
Okay. I mean, it seems a little...
It's totally different to me.
Yeah. But
it's very... It actually doesn't seem to me like Memento is really trying to have you experience memory. It's very like a, you know, it's kind of more like a clinical, you know,
and about idea. Sort of uncovering information in a new way. Mm-hmm. All right. So keep it or kick it. Mm-hmm. For me, this is not a question of if. It's a question of how high it's going to be on my list and how many categories for the Oscars I'm going to say in our 2004 episode, this one should win. Uh-huh. That's where I am.
Yeah. Same here. When I was thinking about where does this rank, it's like I've watched about 100 movies, more than 100, from our 99 to 04 list here. Mm-hmm. And it's in the category of the top three for me. Mm. So of that 100 so far, with Punch Drunk Love and Fight Club.
Yeah, I mean, that I can't argue with you. I mean, I think you're a little wilder.
I'm higher on Fight Club than you are.
Well, I was going to say you're a little bit bigger on putting things at the top.
Yeah,
I think that three is a little bit...
I like hyperbole.
It's a little constricting for me. I'm going to say my top five. I'll put it in there. But you know what? It might be in my three.
What else is in your three? Is Punch Drunk Love in your three?
I don't know.
Because I was wondering, this seemed like we have frequently diverged in our opinions of what is the top movie.
Yeah.
But I feel like this could be like a Punch Drunk Love moment.
Yeah. this is another thing we always come back to on this show, that the whole idea is to pit one movie against the other. But I have a really hard time when they're two movies I love or when they're two movies that are completely different.
Yeah.
Like a, you know, Kill Bill versus Punch Drunk Love. It's like, how do you compare the two? So I don't know. I'm so bad at picking favorites. I would really have to like sit down and make a full pros cons list. Yeah. I would have to talk to my life coach.
You have to have a panel, panel discussion. And then ultimately you got to consult Rotten Tomatoes.
Well, I don't know about that.
Et cetera, et cetera.
Didn't I say that Raya and the Last Dragon has a higher score than this on Rotten Tomatoes? So let that be the last time that we bring up Rotten Tomatoes on this show. Deal?
Deal. All right. In the next episode, we will talk about The Aviator, Martin Scorsese's long, drawn-out, birth-to-old-age biopic, hitting all the high points of Howard Hughes' life, starring Leonardo DiCaprio.
Oh, God forbid. We want to hear from you. Where does Eternal Sunshine rank on your movies of 04, on the movies of your life?
Movies of the decade.
The movies
of the century.
Of the century. Let us know. We want to hear your thoughts. You can find us at bestpicturethis.com, on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Best Picture This. And for 15 years of Golden Takes, head over to Letterboxd where you'll find me, Mike Cavalieri.
To support the show and help us select a movie for a bonus episode, visit patreon.com/bestpicturethis.
Thanks to WNZF and to our illustrious producer Mark Gilliland. And please remember to rate, review, and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your pods.
Thank you for listening to Best Picture This, where, like Charlie Kaufman, we embrace the notion of failure.
Every day.